Hello, my relatives. You humble me. Bill Owens. Do you get it now? You can count on your toes. You'll be able to count the percentage points of contribution to the budget of the University of Colorado you and your ilk have reduced your taxpayer contribution to. It comes to 7. I do not work for the taxpayers of the state of Colorado. I do not work for Bill Owens. I work for you. That's my institutional role, and I take it very seriously. I take the institution and its well-being, its mission, and its ability to perform that mission very seriously. That's one piece. That's where I am, and that's who has invited me to speak. But here is another reality. I am not an abstract, detached academic. I have responsibilities and grounding in an actual community. I take those responsibilities very seriously. In fact, they are preeminent. I don't answer to Bill Owens. I don't answer in the sense that they think I do to the Board of Regents. The Board of Regents should do its job and let me do mine. And if Tom Lucero and his friends want to debate the propriety of that, I welcome them to come and join an open dialogue. I have not yet been officially informed they were even having a meeting about me. I read it in the Rocky Mountain News. I watch it on TV. I understand I'm being reviewed. I haven't been notified of that in any official sense either. But my preeminent, as I said, is I come from an actual community, and I have responsibilities to that community. And it comes from what I was taught and the values that were imparted to me within that community. And in peace. It comes from a Muskogee elder by the name of Philip Deer, which some of you older people in the room may actually even have heard speak on this campus. He is a very important man. And he gave me a certain instruction at one point, which had to do with the way I was raised, which was outside of my tradition. It was in my 20s before I was allowed the opportunity, given the nature of the experience of my people at the hands of the United States. I was in my 20s before I was given any opportunity to make a direct connection. And Philip said, that can be to your advantage. You understand our ways. You did not grow up in them. You understand them. You understand the values. You understand the issues. And you were able to frame those because of the way you were raised in terms that are understood by others. And it's your job. You take that which the Creator gave you and you follow that path. You make your words your weapons and you say things that you understand to be true and you understand them clearly and you never ever back up. And that's what I do. That is consistent with the Muskogee tradition. It's consistent with the tradition of every person on this stage. And you know what? It's also consistent with the tradition of Thomas Jefferson and of Kwame Nkrumah and of any number of people from different cultures where integrity and truth are valued. This is held as an ideal. We share that in common. We share that in common in terms of an aspiration, but we also share that in common as an obligation. Now, a number of things have been imputed to me by what shall I call this? The Boulder Denver equivalent of the National Enquirer at this point, or the Star. couldn't make the case on the issue, and so now my pedigree becomes the issue. Can you call me? I got a very important question. I get a call today from an unregistered Irishman. Okay? Very important question. Can you put me in touch with some of your buddies from Vietnam? We're going to send a film crew to your high school. These people haven't seen me in 40 years. They have nothing to do with this. The issue was not sustainable, so I am to become the issue. Well, later for that. Later for that. My identity does not come from some punk editorial page editor at the Rocky Mountain News or the Boulder Daily Camera. I am the man, it is said, on the talk shock radio in the Denver area who has called for the deaths of millions of Americans. Someone show me where I said that. I am the man who has justified what I consider to be natural inevitable. You do not justify the natural or the inevitable. You make comment on it. You don't have to advocate it. You don't have to justify it. You simply point to it. No, I did not call. A bunch of food service workers, janitors, children, firefighters, and random passers-by, little Eichmanns. It says clearly in that passage, which perhaps I should have amplified further in terms of the connotation of Eichmann, because I understood people would understand as I did what Eichmann symbolized, but apparently not. It says clearly in that passage, the reference is to a technical core of empire, the technicians of empire. Someone want to give me a coherent definition by which someone who is 18 months old, or someone who serves food for a living, or someone who pushes a broom, or someone who is trying to save people in the building, or someone who is just walking by becomes a technician of any sort. Obviously, I was not talking about these people. I was talking about some very specific technical cadre who make this particular system hum, and I'm going to come back to that in a second. But the people at issue, and these are the only people who have been raised. The construction is fairly clear. I've been told it was a bad rhetorical device. Well, I don't think so. You got a better rhetorical device, go use it. Make people think about this your way. This was mine. The people at issue on that red herring would be referred to by Don Rumsfeld or Schwarzkopf and the other people who stand at the podiums in official fora to make pronouncements in behalf of the federal government of the United States. Those people, those firefighters, those service workers, those children would be referred to as something called collateral damage, not even as human beings. And that was implicit to the formulation. But now let me come back a little bit to what my argument actually was. Once the diversion to one phrase out of one sentence, out of one 20-page essay, out of 24 published volumes, 70 book chapters, and 100 jury journal articles, that one little phrase. I'll come back to it. What did I really say? And why did I say it? Well, there were certain questions being posed on the day I wrote that essay. Before the buildings even came down, and I watched it in real time, I heard the whole thing described as senseless. Not it seems senseless, it might be senseless, no. Here's how you're to frame and understand this. It's senseless. And I'm saying to myself, how could they possibly know this? Did they arrange it? No, I'm not making that accusation. The point is clear, however, they couldn't possibly know that it was senseless. Senseless means to have no purpose. You really believe that this operation was carried out for no purpose. You can agree with the purpose, you can disagree with the purpose, but you can't rationally consign this to having no purpose whatsoever. What might that purpose be? Well, I come from a certain context. I come from a certain set of experiences. They're real experiences. They're not abstract experiences. And based on those experiences, I do a little kid's game called dot to dot. This dot connects to that dot, connects to that dot, and hey, if you connect the dots, you get a pattern, and actually on that pattern, you start to understand something. Let me take the first dot. Okay? You were addressed by someone from the Pine Ridge Reservation a few moments ago. There's a county on the Pine Ridge Reservation, Shannon County. Shannon County has been the absolute poorest county in the United States for 50 of the last 50 years. And by poorest, I don't mean unable to afford to get the new color TV, gee whiz, I can't trade my truck. I'm talking about a per capita income of less than $3,000 per year to try to survive South Dakota winters. I'm talking about an unemployment rate that runs into the 90th percentile every year. I'm talking about a life expectancy that's one-third shorter, generation in, generation out, than the average American. One-third truncation of a lifespan, and that's the overall data with regard to reservation-based Native North America. Urban-based is not appreciably better. That's 35th percentile attrition of the population, every generation for the last five generations. I don't know how you define a genocidal impact of policy imposition, but that comes real close in my book. Okay, I call it genocide. It comes through a degree of impoverishment that results in a continuous dome of death from malnutrition, nutritionally related diseases, continuous tone of death, and immiseration from readily communicated diseases. I'm talking about a third world degree of impoverishment of an entire people based on the racial definition imposed on us, by the federal government of the United States in behalf of its imagined constituency, which includes everybody else. Not on an even playing field, but in gradients. And the degree of impoverishment devolves from something called plenary power that the federal government has assigned itself. If there's any law professors in the room, you'll know what I'm talking about. Plenary power, in plain English rather than legalese, means absolute, unchallengeable power to make disposition of our affairs and our assets. With that, they've assigned themselves a trust authority over those assets. When those assets are exploited by American corporations, they're exploited at a discount royalty rate, discount deep, 90%. They're paying 10 cents on the dollar what they'd be paying on the open market for the minerals, and the money does not go to the people whose minerals they were. It's placed in trust accounts administered by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. You want to know where Indian destitution comes from? You want to know why our lifespans are truncated accordingly? You want to know why our children are so desperate that they are committing suicide at 14 times the national average? You want to know why all those things come together? Right now there's a case in the federal courts, Cobell, in which it is conceded that the Bureau of Indian Affairs, in combination with the Treasury Department of the United States government, has misplaced $150 billion worth of assets. Cash, money. By federal count, there's 2 million Indians. You want to divide 2 million into $150 and see what our standard of living would be if it wasn't being spent on designer overpasses, if it wasn't being spent on the accoutrements of the quality of life that every American yuppie has decided that they are divinely entitled to enjoy? Does that make me angry? Yeah, it does. Churchill's angry. He speaks angrily. He speaks forcefully. I don't think the issue, however, is why Churchill would be angry about that. The question is why Governor Bill Owens and the Board of Regents are not. I need that nothing to say. And I link that up in my mind to what was then pronounced to be approximately 565,000 Iraqi children who had died needlessly in less than 5 years. By needlessly, they too were dying of nutritionally related illnesses. They too were dying of readily curable diseases because of a set of sanctions that the United States foisted off on the pretext of it being UN and imposed in order to make the people themselves scream to the point where they would compel their leadership to become free, as defined by George Herbert Walker Bush, meaning to understand that what we say goes. This was no mystery. This was an official UN report. It was confirmed. It was known to be confirmed by Madeleine Albright, U.S. ambassador at the time to the United Nations, on no less public a venue than 60 Minutes in 1996. Leslie Stahl asked her, "Are you aware of this? These 500,000+ children of another people?" And she says, "Yes, we're aware. We've decided it's worth